Ruth, welcome to A Life in Biography.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be invited.
Well, thank you. Let's start with you introducing yourself and explaining how you got interested in Ernest Gaines.
The book that I published with LSU Press last year is called Cherie Quarters, The Place and the People That Inspired Ernest J. Gaines. And in the book, my introduction, I describe how I met him. I was working at LSU Press, believe it or not, as a copy editor. And Charles East was the executive director at the time, and he came up to the second floor where the copy editors worked, and he had a man with him who was wearing a brown beret, and he had a few books in his hands, and he introduced him as Ernest Gaines, and he said he was in Baton Rouge to help find settings for the filming of The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, which was published in 1971, and it was being filmed for television, for CBS. So, I had never heard of Ernest Gaines before. And Charles E. said, if anybody up here, there were four of us working upstairs as editors, wants to go hear him give a reading, he's going to give a reading this afternoon at such and such a building on campus. And if you would like to leave the office and go hear him read, you may do that. So I think it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I went over there. It was a building where English was taught called Lockett Hall. And Beverly Jarrett, who also was working at the press then as the head of the editors, she and I walked over together, and it was basically a classroom. And Warren Eiser was the teacher, and he introduced Ernest Gaines, and he said he's going to read one of his short stories, and I want my students to pay attention to point of view in this story, because that's what they were studying at the time. And I think it was a creative writing class, I believe, that he was teaching. So Ernest Gaines read a short story called Just Like a Tree, which is the final story in his book of short stories, Bloodline. And I just thought it was really wonderful. And it starts out with a young boy, and then, the final voice is that of an old woman. The story is basically tragic. She's having to be moved out of the quarters where she's lived her entire life because of civil rights activities that are beginning, and there people are worried that she's going to be hurt. And so it was a tragic story in a way, but with lots of humor, especially in the dialogue. And I was just riveted. It's really moving. And after he finished reading that, he gave a little bit of a talk about himself. And he said he had grown up across the river in Pointe-Coupee Parish, which is about a 30-minute drive across the Mississippi River from Baton Rouge. And he had grown up on a plantation. And at the age of 15, his parents, his mother and stepfather, had sent him a train ticket. And he packed up a suitcase. He was 15 years old, stood out on the highway and flagged down the Trailways bus, and it stopped, and he had to wave his handkerchief to get the bus to stop, and it picked him up. He went to the back of the bus, And then he rode to New Orleans, got off, found his way to the train station, and then he got on a train that took him to Crockett, California, which was near Vallejo. And then I think that's where probably his mother and maybe one of his brothers met him at the train. And he said what he had noticed was that in the beginning, the races were separated, but by the time they got into California, everybody was all mixed up together. So I was just so fascinated. I had never done any writing at that point, except I had taken poetry classes with Miller Williams, who is Lucinda Williams's father. And I had done some book reviews for the Baton Rouge Morning Advocate, but I thought I cannot let this person just walk away. I have to have more information. And there was a new publication in the English. Couple of graduate students had started a magazine called Gulfstream. So I looked at Beverly and I said, I'm going to see if I can interview him for Gulfstream. And she just kind of gave me this strange look, like, what are you talking about? And I went up to Mr. Gaines and introduced myself and asked him if, he would be willing to let me interview him. And he said, yes, he would. So we agreed to meet at the LSU Student Union the following Saturday. And I went straight to the Union Bookstore. I bought a paperback copy of Miss Jane Pittman and speed read it. And I borrowed a tape recorder from a friend. And then I met him in the Union. And we sat and talked for several hours and drank coffee. And eventually that piece, I transcribed it into a blue book, like you take exams in college, and then eventually typed it up. And Lewis Simpson was one of the editors at the Southern Review. He asked to see it and ended up publishing it. So, that was a wonderful way to start out, and I just continued to follow Gaines's career. I went back and caught up with the books that I had already missed, including the novel that really is my favorite one of all of his works. It's called Of Love and Dust. And then his first novel was Catherine Carmier. And the book of short stories is called Bloodline. And I think that's really one of his best. They're beautiful stories, five of them. So I just continued to follow him. And then in the early 90s, I approached Rick Smith at Louisiana Public Broadcasting and said, I think we should do a television documentary about Ernest Gaines. So it took us a couple of years to get ourselves organized. But we did end up making an hour-long television documentary. So we don't even cover his entire career because at the time the documentary ends, he had not yet published A Lesson Before Dying. But the documentary is out there. It can be viewed on YouTube, and it's online. And we were able to spend a week in San Francisco and interview his mother, which was really great, and his sister, and two of his sisters, and several of his brothers. He was the oldest of 12. So, we got to spend time. We got to see his apartment on Divisadero Street in the Western Addition of San Francisco. And, we even got to go sailing with him. He co-owned a sailboat with some other men. They called it the Curmudgeon. And we did some filming there that actually ended up on the cutting room floor. So I just still to this day, I think he's one of the greatest, least known great writers in this country. I really think he's not that well known. Despite all the honors he's received, people in Louisiana know who he is, but I think in the rest of the country, people still aren't that familiar with him. So I'm hoping that, you know, my book will help. It's partly a biography, and then I expanded into the quarters where he grew up. These were cabins built in the 1840s, definitely slave cabins. And I go into the white families who were the owners of the plantation. And then my final chapter is about efforts to preserve the last two remaining standing slave cabins. And I think we were just ahead of our time. You know, people now understand the value of slave cabins, but when we were trying to do it, it wasn't that well understood. So that kind of covers, you know, my story. And I ended up writing about him for various magazines and newspapers, along with, you know, writing other things. And I was a stringer for People magazine for a while, which was interesting. Wrote for some national magazines, and actually right now I'm taking a couple of classes online and getting back into writing more, you know, short pieces. So,
okay. Well, I have a lot of questions based on what you've just said. First of all, Ruth, do you mind telling us how old you were when you met Ernest Gaines?
I'm trying to think. It was 1972. So I would have been 28.
Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, I was 11 years younger than Ernie. He would have been 39 at that point.
Do you have any idea, any sense of why he agreed to be interviewed by you?
That is kind of mystifying. You know, he certainly, well, he had met me through Charles East.
Right.
And from what I understood, they had spent the weekend previous driving him around. They had gone to Parlange Plantation, which is in Pointe-Coupee Parish, and talked to the owners there and, you know, been invited inside for what Ernie called coffee in them little bitty cups, the demi-tasse. And so maybe it was the fact that Charles East, you know, had introduced me to him. That connection may have helped, I think. And actually later on, he wrote a letter to Charles that Charles showed me. And he said, you know, I met Ruth Laney and we talked for hours. A very intelligent girl. That's what he said in the letter.
Well, this is what I'm getting at. It may have something to do with the fact, to use his words, that you were he thought you were an intelligent girl. You weren't certainly a professional biographer at that point. You weren't an academic. You weren't a journalist. You were someone who obviously got interested in him on the strength of his own presentation.
Right.
And I can't prove it. And perhaps there's no way in which we can establish this. But I have this hunch, this intuition, that that's part of what he responded to in you. And in a sense, you are one of the people that he was writing for, not simply to be, you know, recognized as a great writer and other things, but to connect with people like you.
That may be true. You know, it kind of amazes me as I look back, because
He wasn't always the most polite person. You know, he could be very curt, as you demonstrate in your book. He could be gruff. he didn't suffer fools, as far as I can see. So he may very well have been responding to what he saw as a kind of authenticity, genuine quality that made him open up.
I think you're right. And, you know, I noted it. I wrote some notes later. Quite a few of the people in the room were academic types.
Yeah.
You know, I described them as the leather patched. You know, they were sort of like, okay, let's almost approaching with the let's see, you know, what you can do attitude. And also, and I mentioned this to him in the interview, I was so moved by the ending of the story, and I just kind of wanted to sit there and absorb it. But they immediately jumped in and started asking him these academic type.
Yeah, yeah. People have an agenda. Yeah, and you didn't have that kind of agenda.
Right.
I think that made a big difference. I'm always, as I, you know, respond to writers, I think of my touchstone, William Faulkner, and how he was interviewed by many, many different kinds of people. And generally, the reviews that reveal the most about him are his conversations with younger women. Now, he sometimes had an agenda in terms of
right.
flirting and trying to seduce these women. Nonetheless, we live in a world of mixed motivations, like Gene Stein got more out of him in terms of learning about what he was about as a writer than, say, more professional interviewers. She was quite young when she, you know, she became quite a professional herself, but she was just starting out when she met William Faulkner. And I think that made a difference to him, that he was talking to someone who was just starting out.
Right. And, you know, I also think, in a funny way, women have an advantage in these situations because we are not threatening.
Yes.
Or maybe not as threatening.
Yes.
As a male interviewer might be.
Yeah.
So that's just a theory I have.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times a woman, I even notice this on television too, can draw more information out.
Yes.
And I think it might be because, you know, maybe it's a matter of empathy. Again, not being a threat.
Yeah. When I decided to do a biography of Susan Sontag, I immediately turned to my wife and I said, we have to do this book together because I will never get the kind of response from people if you're not in the room with me. Right. And this proved to be true. I've written about this, about, you know, the difference it made in writing the book with a woman, about a woman, and interviewing, you know, certain people who might otherwise have been very hostile, or at the very least suspicious of me as a professional biographer. Oh, this is another subject he's interested in, you know, and so on. It made a big difference. And so what you're saying is makes sense. You mentioned this documentary was Gaines at all reluctant about that project, or did this just seem to be part of a natural evolution of things?
You know, I was definitely the connection to him.
Yeah.
He had already appeared on a brief interview on LPB, a one-time interview, a short one. But when I went to Rick Smith, Rick Smith was the LPB connection. He worked there. He was a producer. And he didn't seem reluctant at all, you know, and I told him that we needed a a letter from him just basically saying, you know, I give you permission.
Yeah.
And he said, you write the letter and I'll sign it. and actually, I think I ended up actually signing it for him. But yeah, we had definitely had his permission and his agreement. And as time went on, I think we ended up working on it for about 2.5 years. I think as time went on, and I mentioned this in the book, you know, he got kind of sick of being followed around and filmed.
Right.
There were times, I think I mentioned this in the book too, where we were filming some of his family portraits. You know, he had photographs of Aunt Augustine, Miss Augustine Jefferson, the crippled, as he put it, great aunt who raised him, and other members of his family. And, you know, they were framed with glass. So we were setting them on an easel and taking film footage of them, you know, video footage. And Ernie was in the back. This was his house in Lafayette. Getting dressed, he was going to make some sort of presentation that night. We were going to film that as well. And somebody jostled the easel, and the picture fell off and the glass broke.
Mm.
And just at that moment, the front doorbell rang. Somebody was delivering a package, and Ernie came walking in his sock feet. You know, he was in the back getting dressed in a suit, and we had to warn him, you know, be careful, there's broken glass on the floor.
Mm.
He let us know very clearly that he was not happy. So I got the recording of my voice is actually on the video. I called around Lafayette. I found a frame shop that could do it quickly. And then Rick picked up the broken frame or the broken glass, you know, he took it in, got it reframed. And by the time he got back, we were waiting for him on the front steps. And, you know, he was bringing it back good as new. And he pretended to trip on the curb, you know, just to try to inject a little levity into the situation.
Yeah.
And Ernie made it clear that he was not amused. So he definitely had, and people who know him well definitely know that look, you know, that expression.
Yeah.
So I think toward the end, he might have been, you know, willing to get rid of these people once and for all. But he did say, we premiered it in Lafayette because that's where he lived. And he did say, you know, I've watched it 3 times now and I've cried every time.
Mm.
Which I certainly took as a compliment. And he also told me that he loved the music. And we had been very, very careful, Rick and I. We pulled an all-nighter to set the music track. And we were definitely using pieces that were meaningful to him, like pictures at an exhibition. He said he had played that a lot while he was writing Miss Jane Pittman.
Mm-hmm.
And certain blues songs that he liked, and we wove into, you know, the music track. And he let us know that he was pleased with, you know, what we had done with the music. So, you know, I think he liked it.
Yeah, yeah. How do you get from interviewing him, publishing an interview, then doing a documentary, and then doing a book? How does the book come about?
Well, I got a call from a man named Sid Gray, who had seen my documentary, and I knew Sid, you know, I'd known him over many years, but hadn't seen him in a while. And he said, you know, they're removing the cabins, the quarters was basically a road with cabins on either side. And the cabins on one side of the road belonged to one cousin, and the cabins on the other side belonged to Madeleine Bonchot Caillé. And the ones who belonged to her cousin were being dismantled because he wanted to go ahead and turn the land over to sugarcane, which, you know, sugarcane was grown on the plantation. So Sid went to Magnolia Mound Plantation in Baton Rouge. They were trying to sort of bring in outbuildings and were particularly looking for a slave cabin. So he went to Gwen Edwards, who at the time was the head of Magnolia Mound Plantation. And she said, yes, I would very much like, you know, to have whatever they're taking down. So they were moved. I think three or four cabins were actually moved. Eventually, one of them was reassembled, and Sid had a system of marking the bricks and the boards so that they could be reassembled. But eventually, only one of them ended up being reassembled, and it can be visited now. And we don't know where the rest of the bricks and boards ended up, but he was the one who called me, and, you know, I sort of got involved through him. And then people who had grown up in Cherie Quarters, and there were still people living there then, they were coming out to watch it being dismantled. Some of them were taking photographs, and I started talking to them. And one in particular, David Bibbin, who was called Ben, and I actually dedicated my book to him. He really, really wanted to save those last two cabins. So we started a group, Sid and I, called the Friends of Cherie Quarters. Ben was a member. We got Ernie to join us. We asked Madeleine Caillé, the owner of the plantation, to join us. And then we would have meetings at a local restaurant. But little by little, it just became clear that this was not going to happen. And at a certain point, you know, the people on the side of the road where the cabins were being dismantled had to leave. So that left Shug Edwards living in the last inhabited cabin, a woman, older, living alone out in the middle of nowhere. Mm. So she didn't last long. I think one of her sons came and stayed there with her, and then they found her another place to live and moved her out. But her cabin was in really good shape because it had been lived in all those years. So that was one that we were hoping to save. The other one was way down at the other end, and that was occupied by Reese Spooner, who was one of the old men who talked to Ernest Gaines, you know, a generation older. And eventually we realized, you know, we were not going to succeed with our project. But I do write about that.
Yes, you do. So you can't save everything.
Right.
So one way of saving it is to do the book.
Exactly. Exactly. And I started, you know, I was made to feel so welcome by especially Ben and his family. His sister Barbara was the person who organized family reunions every few years. I was always invited to the reunions. And in fact, Sid and I were invited one year to be the entertainment. And so we showed, we had a slide lecture that we developed called Cherie Quarters, The Place and the People. So he would talk about the buildings. I would talk about the families. So I was always made to feel welcome by the people that I met who were from there. And I, you know, I've started a Facebook group called Cherie Quarters, The Place and the People. And many people are joining it who did grow up there, or who are descended from people who grew up there. And they're learning about their own families. And some of them are reading the book and learning about their own families.
Yeah.
So that's been really rewarding to me, to know that there's something out there that they can come and look at and connect with. And some of them have given me photos that I've never seen before to, you know, to share. So, I feel lucky again to have been welcomed in. And, you know, at one point, Ben's wife, Carol, said, "Your family," which meant a lot to me. And I remember one time a bunch of them were going to go into the church, which had been moved onto Ernest Gaines's property. He was able to get permission to get the church and move it. And we were at one of the graveyard cleanups, which they have every year at, right before what they call Toussaint, Feast of All Saints. So they were getting ready to go inside the church. And I said, "Are white people allowed to come?" And Barbara turned to me and she said, "You not white." I consider that a compliment. You know, yeah. I just felt like I was part of the family and was basically treated that way, not by every single person for sure, but by many. And so, again, with Ben, I got very, very lucky because he seemed to remember everything. So I could ask him what crops were growing in this month, and he would tell me. So much of the information came from him. His brother Sam, who now lives in San Francisco, has also helped me a lot with information. You know, going way back, like who lived where. So, you know, and of course, I value these friendships greatly and feel very honored to be accepted.
I can see the book as a natural, organic outgrowth of, you know, all your other activities related to Gaines and his world and to the quarters and your wish to sort of preserve all of that. You did face, or maybe you didn't, but one alternative to what you did was just writing a conventional biography. What you've written is a kind of group biography and a kind of geographical view of his world, which contains, certainly, it's biographical. I wouldn't have reviewed it for the New York Sun if I didn't feel that it had that, that sense of biography in it. But you did decide not to do sort of the cradle to grave sort of biography.
Well, two things happened. When Ernie retired from teaching at UL, it's now called University of Louisiana at Lafayette, I went to his retirement party, and there was a man there interviewing somebody, and I spoke to him, and I asked him, are you writing an article? And he said, "I'm writing a biography of Mr. Gaines." His name was Rudolph Bird. I'm not sure how many years later he died. He had a brain tumor. Then within a few years, a man named John Lowe, L-O-W-E, was announced as the authorized biographer of Ernest Gaines. So he was writing the official biography. And I knew that while I was finishing my book, although I'd been working on my book for a really long time. So that, you know, was going to be the biography. And when was it? Some months ago, John Lowe died. And from what I understand, another academic, John taught English at LSU, and then later moved to Georgia and was teaching at the University of Georgia, which apparently was where he grew up. And then very unexpectedly, he died. I think it was back in August. I'm not sure. So, no, you know, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. Apparently, he had turned in an 800-page manuscript, but I don't know where he had turned it in to. I was not aware of whether or not he had a publisher.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a big question mark at this point.
Well, it's a good thing to be through.
Somebody else has taken it over and will be. So it's going to be, I think, more of a literary biography.
Right.
And not at some point, John and I spoke on the phone. He had read my book and he was pursuing some of my sources.
Sure.
People that I had been talking to for years.
Yeah.
And some of them were talking to him and some were saying, you need to call Ruth.
Yes.
So we were talking and if you know, I'm very interested to read his book. And he actually pointed out some things that I found very interesting that he had noticed. So that is just a really unfortunate set of circumstances. And I do hope the book comes out. You know, if you've just finished a manuscript, I would say 2 years maybe before publication.
Yeah.
Or, you know, depending on who's going to do it and how much, how quickly they want to move, you know, who knows? And I understand that the Library of America is supposed to release a complete set of Gaines's books.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's good.
But I don't know if they're going to release the biography or not.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Well, it's quite a saga, quite a story that you've been involved in for decades.
I have.
Yeah, a long, long time. Are you going to do something else?
You know, right now, I'm desperately seeking a man named Lindsay Johns. I just saw a wonderful article he had written for the Telegraph, British newspaper, where he says, you know, Ernest Gaines is not even known in the UK, and he certainly should be.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's written an article about Gaines suggesting, you know, starting with a gathering of old men and reading his work. And I want to send him a copy of my book.
Sure. You know? Absolutely.
Yeah. But I can't, this man is very hard to find. Like if you go, you know, he's all over if you Google, but there's no contact address. I've found one person who seems to be handling contact for him, and I've written and asked about him, but haven't yet heard anything. This piece only came out about a week ago, so it's pretty early. But I love the fact that he's drawing attention to Gaines, and many people have told me after reading my book, then they went out and started reading Gaines.
Sure.
And nothing can make me happier than that. You know, yeah. If that brings somebody into the fold, you know, what more could you ask for?
That's so, right.
And a lot of them are the people who are in Shreveport's, you know, they descended from one of the families. And now that they've read the book, they want to read his work because his work all reflects growing up in the quarters. So it's going to be any one of the stories will depict the type of atmosphere that their own families experienced.
Yeah, it's all I can say is I pity the poor biographer who comes after you. They keep telling the biographer, you got to talk to Ruth.
I have what?
they'll say you have to talk to Ruth.
Yeah. No. Well, I love that. You know.
Yeah.
And you know, when I have given one talk at Magnolia Mound Plantation. And we set it outside next to the cabin so that after I finished my talk, we could go into the cabin. And Levert Kemp, who has been a great source of information for me, he was standing it's a double cabin. Basically, they were built for two families, one on each side.
Mm.
If it was a really large family, they might get the entire cabin, but frequently it was two families. And he was saying, you know, my aunt so-and-so lived on this side and my aunt so-and-so lived on this side, you know, so I'm related on, you know. And then at one point several years ago, I gave a lecture at Magnolia Mound, and then we visited the cabin, and one of the men there said, I grew up in this cabin. You know, this is where I grew up.
Yeah.
So to be able to see it, you know, really is meaningful.
Yeah, it's quite an experience. Is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't ask you?
I think maybe, you know, we describe it as partly a memoir.
Yes.
And so I think another way that it may be different from the typical biography, but I won't know until I see John Lowe's, because I think he and Ernie became good friends. You know, I'm also recounting my friendship with Ernest Gaines, which of course it did develop into a friendship over, you know, so many years.
Sure.
I guess what I might want to know is how unusual a book is this? A combination of bio, memoir, social history, pleading, you know, save those slave cabins if there are any left. I'm not sure how typical it is as a biography.
Yeah, I think it's unusual in the combination that you just articulated. In other words, biographical subjects have had their Boswells.
Right.
But you're doing more. You're certainly, there's the memoir aspect, and there's the interviewing about Gaines, but there's also your friendship with him. And then I think most importantly, and what makes your book stand out, is this creation of the quarters, you know, the attempt to reconstruct a whole world, which of course tells you a lot about the writer and the people he came from. So in that sense, I can't think of any example. Maybe some of our listeners will tell me, oh, you've forgotten about this or you ignored that. But I think they ought to look at your book as I think quite a unique product.
It definitely is. And
for one thing, there's your decades of engagement with the subject. You know, that's certainly beyond what I've tried to do, you know, staying with, in a sense, a subject and that subject's world over such a length of time.
Right. And I, you know, I think I started writing it. Actually, I got a Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities grant. And, you know, I had a deadline. So I can remember, you know, kind of working steadily, you know, to meet that deadline and to turn in the manuscript.
Sure.
And you know, I feel lucky for that because I feel like that set me on that path. You know, I have to produce something, and you know, if I hadn't had that, and but you know, I'd be interrupted from time to time, like any freelance writer, except, you know, maybe the real superstars. At there would be times that I would have to take a job, you know, a full-time job, which certainly cuts into writing time. And so partly I think the reason, and also, you know, I actually submitted it to LSU Press way back, and they were very interested in it. Well, you know, fast forward to now and all the personnel has changed.
Yes. You know? Yes.
So the acquisitions editor who wanted it originally is no longer there. So, you know, it did. And I, of course, there were times when I just put it aside, right?
Yes.
And just let it go. Another thing I'm real concerned about, and I'm curious to know, I've kind of followed your story along these lines. I want to donate my papers and possibly even the books, probably the books. And it looks like it's going to be Hill Library in Baton Rouge, which is where I live. It's part mm-hmm. of LSU. And I've spoken to a person there who's very, very interested in having the collection. Because, you know, the terrifying thought is, what's going to happen to all of this when I'm no longer here?
That's right.
And so, yeah. And I've also used Hill Library to, I tried really, really hard to figure out what was the exact date that I met Ernest Gaines. So I went back and I looked at the student newspaper, trying to see if maybe there was some announcement, you know, writer coming to visit, you know.
Yeah.
But I was unable to find that. But it's one of those archives where you've got to wear the gloves.
Oh yeah.
You can only write in pencil, and you have to put all your stuff in the locker before they let you in, you know.
Well.
And you have to sit facing forward. You know, you can't turn your back to the person at the desk. So it's a real archives.
Yeah. Now you can tell them I've got one more item for you, a podcast.
Yeah. And the other thing I've done, I actually have all the video, which is 60 hours worth of video from the documentary. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And I turned it over to a man here in town. I could have done the legacy box thing, but I was too afraid to ship it out of town.
Yeah.
So I would just take it little by little to a man here who, you know, puts it on a flash drive. So I've actually got all the scenes. You know, there might be one man who we only have on camera for 30 seconds.
Sure.
But we might have interviewed him for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, you know, I've got that. And several people have asked me, so-and-so was my father. Where is he in the documentary? I want to hear his voice.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. So I've also got that, which, you know, I can also make that available. And it amazes me, but I've actually still got the original tape from when I interviewed Ernie the very first time.
You've got it all.
Perfectly fine.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Ruth.
It has been. I really feel quite honored for you to have invited me. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. And I'm going to post this video, and I'm going to send you a link so that you can post it wherever you like.
Okay. Is it going to be posted today or when?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Usually they process the podcast very fast, so you should be getting it soon.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ruth. Bye-bye.
Bye.